All right, Sally's parents came over to the United States in 1930.
Names?
As Joseph and Goldie Stein. They came over in 1939, if I'm not wrong, it's May 1939. And they settled, they too were brought over by a sister from Poland. They were the lucky ones. They left in May 1939 to arrive in May to here to the United States. They had a sister living here, and they had their married name was Shapiro, you know that. And I think my father-in-law, when he came over, he was working for the OK Grocery, right? There was an OK Grocery, but today it's actually became after that a Giant Eagle. Mm. And later on, he bought one of those smaller stores, they liquidated, and he bought one of those stores. And then he stayed in that business for a while. And this is basically what I know. I mean, there's much more to it, but I mean, basically, yeah, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then actually, when they had a home with the store, and they had a couple holdups, and then they sold that, and they moved to the south side, and that was his last business after that. And he passed away in 1990. At the age of 90, close to 90, he was only 2 months away from 90, and my mother-in-law just passed away 6 weeks ago, and she was 94. Then, this is basically the story. I mean, there's much more to it, but I cannot say much. That is basically the whole story of that. But
what was her name?
Goldie. First, when we got married, we lived on Wendover Street, and after we had our two children, the place we lived in an apartment, and it got too small, and we bought a home, our first home we bought on Shady Avenue Extension, and there our children, when they got to school age, they started school at Mendedeo School. Funny, I just saw today's paper that Mendedeo, now is the 40th anniversary since he was killed as a guard, you know. And that's how I never could have believed it, it's just that long ago. And they went to school, to grade school there, and after then they went to high school, to Taylor Allardyce High School. Sally, he was there. After we got married, actually, Sally was still working. Sally is a school teacher. She started out teaching at Hillel Academy. She stayed there for a while because she couldn't get a job at the city, I mean the public schools, because she was not a citizen. And by the time when her parents became citizens, they forgot to include her. So imagine I became a citizen before she did. She after that had to wait 2 years, and then she got her job at the public schools, and she was teaching. If I'm not wrong, her first school was Ford School. First school was Ford School, you thought?
Yeah.
And then Soho, and then she taught here at Greenfield too. And yes, she taught at all these schools. None of those schools exist anymore. After she left, there was no use to keep the school. Then we had the two children. Sally quit her job and she stayed as a housewife and taking care, because I was away a lot of times, when I traveled. I used to go away on Monday morning and come back Wednesday night. And every 4 weeks I had two weeks like those, that I went away for overnight. And a little, as I said, they grew up and they got bigger and they went back, they started school. Cheryl was the one, first one who left for college. She went for Syracuse, stayed there for a while, for 1 year, and somehow she didn't find, either the school didn't find her, or she didn't find the school. Anyhow, she returned, and she wound up after that at Duquesne, and she graduated from Duquesne in communications. Erica was accepted to Oberlin. She stayed there for 4 years, graduated from Oberlin, and then when she came back, there was no job. She went back to school. She went to the health, fit health, what is it called, something, a one-year program. Well, yeah, that he got, yeah, and she, but she found out she didn't care for that too much. Then she applied to law school and wound up at Pitt Law School, and she graduated from Pitt Law School, and she was working in a law firm here. Cheryl, after graduating, went to Chicago. Her niece was there, I mean her cousin was there, and she wound up to work for the Ramah. She became so-called, I don't know what kind of it was, but the title was anyhow, she worked for the Ramah thing. In summertime she used to be running the camp, Ramah camp in Wisconsin. She stayed there for quite a few years. And after that, Cheryl used to go to Switzerland, and somehow I have a nephew. My nephew who was with me during the war, Peter, he remained in Czechoslovakia after I came to the United States. He went back to school, finished school, and got his engineering title as a chemical engineer. And he was working for the Czech government in Slovakia and Bratislava. And then in 1968, when the Russians occupied Czechoslovakia, he escaped and ran over to Switzerland, and he wound up in Switzerland. And he got a job with Ciba Geigy, and he worked there, and then he was there for five, from 1968, and he's still there, but during the same period he married a woman, his first wife. He divorced his first wife wound up in Budapest. He has one daughter with her, and she's still living in Budapest, the daughter. Mm-hmm. And this, when he was in Switzerland, he met that woman, and then he married this woman. This woman had two children, a daughter and a son. And I know how, what, my father met the son, and they got married, well, how many years ago? Several years ago, anyhow. And she remained in Switzerland. She was working for a good rock company in Switzerland. And he finished medical school, and he stayed there. And after 2 years ago now, it'll be 2 years, they came back to the United States, and they're living in New York. Erica, again, remained with the law firm, and while she was going as a high school student, yes, and there she used to go to Ramah camp in Canada, actually both of them. And there she befriended a young man from Michigan, and they remained good friends. And after that, the amazing part of it is they wound up together in Oberlin again, and they became friends. After they stayed friends, and I don't know how, what, where, and suddenly one day he came to Pittsburgh, and they resumed their courtship, and she became engaged, and she married a fellow, Dan Gale, from Bay City, Michigan, and they settled in Michigan. And they're still living in Michigan. They have one son, by name Noah Jordan. He is now six and a half years old. Noah Jordan. And he was there living in Michigan. He, my son-in-law, is his father. He had a printing shop, and he passed away about 5 years ago, and he took it over. He's been running this printing shop there, and they've been living there so far quite happily. This is basically part of the story of my family. There's much more to it. I mean, if you want to know any kind of details, I can give you, but that is basically it. Cheryl Now back to Cheryl. She has two children. She has a little girl who is will be 4, and the boy will be 2.
Name?
Name is Cheyenne, the girl.
Cheyenne.
C-H-E-Y-E-N-N-E. Cheyenne Mia.
Mm.
Yeah, and the boy is Henry. Mm. Yes.
And the girl is 6 days, 4?
4, yeah, it'll be 4 in June, right. And the boy will be March, I think, now March 2. Yeah, and that's about the story of their basically mm-hmm. the closest what I can come.
Now,
all our secrets, right, there are lots of secrets, there are no secrets at all. Now, this is about...
Do you want to know the truth?
Now this is basically the story about the children. Now mm-hmm. I have, let's put it that, and I became really interested in the Holocaust thing more or less in the 70s already, but there were not many people who were much interested in it. I think the film, or not the film, actually the television serial that was called The Holocaust brought forward much more people became aware of the Holocaust than ever. That was, I think, was the first presentation that it was romanticized, but at the same time it showed the story, what happened during to a lot of families, to a lot of the Jews in Germany and Eastern Europe. I think it was in the 1970s, I think so. It was in the 1970s. Yeah. I don't remember exactly mm-hmm. the date. I don't know. I remember mm-hmm. there were reactions. Yeah. Some people were felt that it is not a real representation of what the Holocaust was, because it was too... First of all, it was romanticized. Number two, it didn't show the real thing, what it was. And I thought, and I had arguments with certain people who I felt, no, they were wrong, because to present it to the American public, if you would present a documentary type thing, nobody would have watched it, nobody would have listened. You had to present it that it should become more, you could feel something, you could be part of it. And I think that has accomplished that thing. And actually, I heard once a speaker from Germany who said that program woke more people in Germany to make more people realize and learn much more about the Holocaust than any other program. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have a lot of documentaries. The best documentary, I think, is the documentary is Lanzmann's called The Shoah. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, 9 hours or something like that. But those are people, not many people, young people, would watch a program like that. This was a real program who depicted, to show the details, all the details of everything about the Holocaust. But that would have never been accepted, and they would have never accomplished what this short serial accomplished. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was still working, kept busy, and little by little I became active in the Holocaust group here. We were starting to form one. I think the first person who became, really did some it for the Holocaust here in Pittsburgh was Isaiah Cooperstein, and he set up here a so-called the Holocaust group. And it was 1981, there was a so-called a gathering of the Holocaust survivors in Jerusalem. And they went to that, there were quite a nice group of people from all over the world, but there was a nice group even from Pittsburgh. And there, people, more and more people started to talk about it and become, bring it to the whole world, because it was advertised. Actually, the whole program was even on national national television, and it was the most moving experience in my life, I think, that I have ever had. When I arrived to Israel and I saw all these people, and the first Saturday night after registration, it was Saturday night after we went to, what is it called, Eliyahu Stadium, something, I can't think of it as, and they had a performance there. And while the performance went on, I see first came out children dancing, and then came out the Israeli police performance and everything, and I was sitting in the seat there, at myself, is that real for real? Is that possible? I could have never imagined that I'll be lived to see the day, and I'll be in Israel sitting there, everything is Jewish, performing, Jewish artists performing, Jewish. It just, it's something that it's very difficult to describe. I don't have the capacity, or I'm not qualified to express, I cannot express really the feeling what feeling it was for me. That was something that it's unforgettable. From there, I remember we went to Washington, to Jerusalem, and there, after the ceremony started there. And there I attended several of them, but two of them that were really unforgettable is the one that was in Yad Vashem one night, and it was in July 1981, and it was a very hot day, but we came out there at the evening with the sunset. We went through their place. I remember there, there's in Yad Vashem a place, I don't remember what it's called. Anyhow, they were full of flowers, children were growing flowers in the memory for all these people. And then we settled and we went and the performance started. There were people, speakers, spoken in English and Hebrew. And it was, of course, it got colder later on. And then they were showing some videos. And the interesting part was to hear me sitting there and in the quiet of the night and everybody just sitting quietly. And then to the end, it came the Kaddish. I mean, there was a lot more there. And then the Kaddish came, everybody stood up. First of all, the Neil Morachmin, and then came the Kaddish. And as quiet as it was, you could almost hear the tears from. It was so people were so taken, but they were in the thousands of that. But that is a night that's incomprehensible. I mean, it's just something, it's beyond. And we got on buses and we returned, and it was, even while we were returning, everybody was quiet. It was, everybody was taken. There were Jews from, as I said, from France, from Holland, from Australia, from Israel, of course, but from United States, was a very large group of United States. Then we went to see other places several days, and on Thursday night, a big night came, and there was a night at the Hotel Maravi, at the Western Wall, and we assembled there. We saw Israeli soldiers everywhere lined up on the rooftops and everything, watching, protecting us, and they were lined up, candles and candles, everybody who came there with a candle. And it started out with that, I mean, just these people looking there, and speakers were, I remember one of them was Elie Wiesel, and this other speaker was Begin. And while we were sitting there, you could hear the, what do you call it, the calling for prayer, the Arab, the Muslims calling for prayer. And you could hear again, even the from the yeshivot, some of these people, yes, it was so quiet. And after it ended, I remember that Begin right away rushed and went out to the Western Wall to pray. And I made a statement. Somebody in the night, I don't know who it was, and said, geez, because it was the year of the election. He's a very good politician. See, he knows how to, what to do. He says, oh no, he's no politician. He's really sincere. He really believes in that, what he's saying. And that time, from then on, I always admired, and I always liked Begin, but from then on, I really respected him, because I saw he was a real sincere man. For better or worse, maybe he made some mistakes, but basically, he did it because he believed what he was doing, and this is the right thing to do. And I stayed in Israel after that for a while, and from there, on my way back, I even stopped in Switzerland to stay a few days with my nephew, and returned to back to Pittsburgh, and I think I came back a different person. I think that has changed a lot of me. It really made me aware much more what the state of Israel means to us and how important it is to have a Jewish state. 1983, there was another gathering, and it was in Washington, D.C. Of course, there were mostly Jews from the United States, but they came to Jews from Canada, a lot of from Canada, from other places too. And there was a very moving affair again. I ran into a lot of friends. I ran into a lot of even cousins that I didn't know they even existed. And here I ran into some very interesting thing. It was while we were on the lawn, and there were speakers, and we were all kinds of, from, I remember one of the speakers was there, Gavison, congressman from Connecticut. There were other ones too. And there were groups, we were all together, and I was standing there, and there was a group talking there, and I went over there, and I listened to him. I was telling one story, another story, and a fellow came over to me, looks at me, and says, "I know you." Yes, we were together in Warsaw, we were together in Mühldorf also. And he started talking. He said, "You maybe not." You see, he was younger than I was, probably about 7 or 8 years younger. I didn't remember because he was a little kid at that time, and I was more already about the same thing. He said, and he recognized me. I think he lives now in Detroit somewhere. Yeah. And in Detroit. And he says, "I always remember you for one thing." And my nephew always tells me too. I always was the one who was the optimist and always say, "Don't give up, keep on, do everything possible. We have to live, somebody has to live, somebody has to tell the story, because if none of us will live, there will be nobody to tell us." He says, "You were an encouragement for me to keep on going." And I felt it was a good feeling to hear somebody else to tell you something like that. I don't know where I got the courage to tell this other people, but somehow we were fortunate enough, all of us, that we got together there and we spent a couple of days yet in Washington. And I returned after that from Washington, and I became very quite active in the Holocaust movement here in Pittsburgh. And since then, actually, I was before already, actually at the Cooperstein, I already was going out to speak to schools, to tell them about the Holocaust. And my first school was the Community Day School. They were at the Hebrew Institute, and I spoke there, and I was very nervous. I remember I didn't know which way to approach and how to come through with it. But it was an introduction for me. I would have never dared to go to a non-Jewish school and speak on non-Jewish school. Here I felt more free, and I knew that you can speak to a group of that. Actually, Linda Horvitz was teaching that time there, and that was my first introduction to the to speak at different schools. Of course, since then I have spoken to a lot of schools, and I find actually that Catholic schools, the children in Catholic schools, that they teach the Holocaust are the best informed ones. Jewish kids are interesting. They have some of them are very reluctant, they're very somehow to ask questions, or beside that, they suddenly, I think that they feel, hey, we could have been the ones, who knows, when you tell the story what happened to all the Jews. So they're uneasy sometimes, but a lot of them who have good teachers and they're understanding, they'll be much better, they're more receptive. And this is about basically what I had with the Holocaust. I'm not still going on. I could tell a lot of stories, a lot of ways, what I encountered during those speaking assignments. There were some very interesting questions. There were some of them that were, some of them were not so interesting, but there were always, a lot of times the question comes up, do you believe in God after you have all experienced it? And that's a very difficult question. I come always with my story back. I don't know whether I might have mentioned it already, that I had the same problems after liberation. I too couldn't accept it somehow. For somebody who was brought up in that type of environment that I was, very orthodox but not fanatic, that I always thought if you follow the precepts and if you say your prayers, or the prayers tells you, if you'll do what you're supposed to do, God will always be there to protect you. Especially if you start that at a young age, it somehow grows on you or what it is, and it's very difficult when something happens to you to, what would be the right word for it, to accept that something like that was thought he did all the things, the right things, and something like that is happening. It wasn't so difficult to accept my own problems, but was much more difficult to accept to see innocent young children who have not lived, who positively have not sinned, and they wound up in the same place as I and the rest of them. And so when they ask me that question, I tell them that I read a book by Rabbi Yeshua Liebman.
Rabbi
Yeshua Liebman. He was a Reform rabbi. And I don't remember which, I think it might have been the book, one of them. I read a couple. Yeshua Liebman.
Joshua Liebman,
yes. I think he was a Reform rabbi.
Yes.
He died very young.
Yeah.
He was a very fine man. He wrote a book. One of them is Peace of Mind, and I think maybe in this book
Peace
I read
of
that.
Mind is
yeah,
the book.
I think maybe in that is the book that I read it. That he knew a young lady who came over and survived the Holocaust, and it came before the high holidays. He said, come with me to shul, you know, it's time. And she says, no way, Rabbi, can I go to shul. After what I have lived through, after what I saw what has done was done to children, I don't believe in God. There is no such a thing. The God for me is not non-existent. And he told her, you know, God had nothing to do with the Holocaust and men. Men are the one who brought on the Holocaust. And that somehow gave me sort of an answer. It's not an answer, but somehow start thinking maybe he is right. Because everything was done by men. And if you believe in the teachings of the actually is, that it goes Hakol b'shamayim chutz meyirah shamayim, everything is heaven in heaven with the exception of fear of God. And because we are all given the choice of our own, the choice of the what we should do or what we shouldn't do, and these people have no fear of God. That's the people who did it, so we have to accept it. If you accept one, you have to accept the other one. And this is my first, of course I read a lot about it, there are other answers, but there are no simple answers, and I think anybody who's trying to answer, I think, doesn't know what he is talking. And I can go back in a quotation, go back to the Torah, and getting to the story about Aaron and his two sons. When they were the high of their glory, they were consumed by fire. And when after that happened, right away everybody found excuses, and it says that God glorifies in the sacrifices of the loved ones, and everybody else said all kinds of, there are so many commentaries. There is one thing that I noted, there is thing, when it says, Vayidom Aharon, and Aharon, Aaron kept quiet. And I think myself, all these people who have not lived through the Holocaust, who are talking about the Holocaust, who are trying to find excuses, would be better off if they would be quiet. Because Aaron was the only one who understood what it means to lose two young sons. Nobody, the rest of them were talking, but he was the one who understood, and that's why he kept quiet. And this is my coming. I am looking for sources, but I think these are the two sources that have me change my a lot of me. The one, the Aaron story, is my own. The other one is Rabbi Liebman. Mm-hmm. And I go from day to day, and that's all it is. Now I'm active in the Jewish community. But I don't know how active I am. I belong to three congregations, and all Orthodox. I belong to, of course, to the Young People Synagogue, IPS. I belong to the Bet HaMedrash HaGadol. There I go every morning to services during the week, and I belong to the Palatzeder. Wherever I don't go, I just play the dues, pay dues.
And why do you do that?
I don't know. I wish I would know. My brothers belong there, and somehow it's more my brother-in-law belong there, and I just do it for, I don't know, probably sentimental reasons or what. I really shouldn't. I should maybe put the money somewhere else, but I still send it to them. I always said the time will come if I'll be able to afford, I'll give, and that's it. I think I read an interesting article about a Hungarian Jew who lives in the United States, and he said his father taught him one thing. His father was a very generous person, always used to give charity. His father told him, says, always give while your hands are warm. He says, because after that you don't know what. He says, give it.